Before we put it out on the market, we had to test it. It was always kind of a gamble trying to figure out how to balance the yeast and the sugar. If you didn't do it right, you'd end up with vinegar that nobody would want. I remember sitting there playing cards with Randy and David, sipping buck and getting drunk. David had the biggest grin on his face. He was always the man with the plan. When we had a good batch, we bought coffee cups at the canteen and opened for business. A cup was $1, and a pitcher, an empty hot water bottle if you had one, went for $3. We made sure we had buck prepared for the 2 paydays. Wednesdays, when they deposited your earnings from your prison job into your inmate trust fund, and Fridays, when you could withdraw again. A few years later, I found out David ended up getting killed trying to escape from Salisbury, another prison. He had jumped the fence and was running toward the second one when a CO shot him in the head. I picture him in those few seconds in between the fences, a stoner grin on his face, high at the thought that freedom was so close. Bars or not, I had to make something of myself. Something more than 40 cents a day in the kitchen. My family did what they could for sending me money from time to time, but I felt bad taking their hard-earned cash. With my profit from the buck, I began to stockpile items from Central's canteen and started my own business running the canteen. I did my business at night, after the prison's canteen had closed for the day. You wanted chips at 9 o'clock p.m.? I had them. I marked things up, usually between 25 and 30 cents. When I had a lot of inventory, I brought in people to work for me, letting them eat what they wanted for free in exchange for keeping chips or cans of soup in their lockers for me. Eventually, I got a reputation for wheeling and dealing. Despite what happened at the last trial, my sister Diane continued to believe that God had spoken to her, and she wrote me often. We've had a hard life, and we still don't have much, but I'm free in my heart. I'm happy in my heart. The Lord knows how much we can bear. He knows the outcome of your life before you got into this situation. There is a reason, Ron. Be free in your heart. That was easy for her to say, of course, because she wasn't sitting in some prison. The closest thing I felt to freedom were the small bursts of joy I had singing. I look forward to getting back to the choir at Central, having missed singing with the guys all those months I had been in Alamance County Jail for the trial. Long after practice ended, the words echoed in my head like another prayer. What a fellowship, what a joy divine, leaning on the everlasting arms. What a blessedness, what a peace is mine, leaning on the everlasting arms. In June, I was transferred to a medium security facility, a farm in Halifax County. It might sound good on paper, going from maximum to medium security, but I think the prison system did it on purpose, shifting people around like gears in a car so you couldn't get too comfortable. And that's exactly what I was. I didn't want to call Central Prison home, but I had lived there for 4 years. I had fought my battles to earn my spot. I didn't want to give up my corner bunk, but I had no choice. Early one morning, COs came to get me, and before I knew it, I was at Sandy Ridge Transfer Terminal, boarding a gray goose filled with other inmates with a sign reading, Caledonia, the same prison Bobby Poole transferred to over a year ago. Caledonia had two components to it, the farm and the huge cannery where all the produce was packaged. I got a job in the cannery. Other inmates picked tomatoes, sweet potatoes, collard greens, and put them on an assembly line, where they were canned, labeled, and thrown down a little chute. That's where I came in. I'd box the cans and send them off to be wrapped and shipped to prisons, schools, and hospitals all over the state. I probably made over 1,000 boxes a day, putting 6 cans in a case and stacking 15 cases on a skid. There was no choir at Caledonia, so I stopped singing and went back to the punching bag. Working out there one day, I felt someone looking at me. Prison really makes you grow eyes on the back of your head. I looked back, and there was Bobby Leon Poole staring at me with his cold eyes. I stared back until he moved off. I turned back to the bag and pounded it. "Cotton, your hands are bleeding," a guy said to me when I returned to the dorm. "I know." For now, it was better than taking it out on another inmate. I rinsed my hands and let the blood dry. Then I lay on my bed and wrote my appellate defender a letter. July 9th, 1988. Dear sir, I'm writing to let you know that I am no longer an inmate at Central Prison. I was recommended for medium custody and transferred to the Tillery Prison Unit. So if you have information concerning my case, I'd appreciate it if you send it to my new location. The unit I'm on now has really put me a great distance from home to where it would be extremely difficult for my family or friends to pay me a visit. Plus, Bobby Leon Poole is on this unit, and I really care not to have him within my view, knowing that I'm serving the time in prison for crimes he committed. I'm not afraid of this Poole guy, but what I am afraid of is having the two of us in the same unit. I feel that something serious might take place between the two of us, and I know deep in my heart that I wouldn't want anything like that to take place. So what I'm asking you to do is see if you can get me back to Central Prison, or at least to another unit. Respectfully submitted, Ronald Cotton. Poole would turn out to be the least of my worries. He was housed on another unit, so I didn't have much contact with him. Medium custody meant you were in an open dormitory, whereas in closed custody you were in a cell. In many ways, being in a cell was a lot safer than being out in an open dorm. Trouble was never hard to find in prison. One night, while I sat out where the TV was to watch the news, this guy Donnie came in, looking like someone had pissed in his cornflakes. "What you doing sitting in my seat?" he yelled. "I don't see your fucking name on it," I replied. It was always important to show you weren't weak, that you couldn't be taken advantage of. Fighting back, even when you lost, earned you respect. Donnie walked out, but I knew it was on. A few days later, I was playing cards with another guy when someone came over and tapped me on the shoulder. I turned, and bam! Donnie popped me in the face. I dove forward, grabbing him around the waist and threw him over my head onto the bunks. He jumped off and straight onto me, wrapping his legs around my waist and choking me. I took off running toward the bars, hoping I'd knock him out by slamming him into them. But he hung on, squeezing my neck so hard I thought I was going to black out. So I took hold of his testicles.
"Let go," I wheezed.
"Let go of my balls," he shouted at me, some of the spit in the corners of his mouth landing on my face. I fell forward across a bunk, hoping to bang his head against the metal edge of it. But I judged it wrong, and the bunk above hit me in the head. I was close to blacking out again when I heard another inmate start whistling, letting Donnie know the COs were on their way. "Motherfucker, this ain't over," he said, getting off me as I grasped for air. Working at the cannery, I got to know a guy named Ricky Sutcliffe, who had curly brown hair and thick glasses. He was serving time for the same charges: first-degree sexual offense, first-degree rape, first-degree breaking and entering, and, like me, he said he was an innocent man. I don't know if he was or wasn't. It was hard to believe anything anyone said. A lot of people in prison say they're innocent. Others lie about their charges. Most people, for security reasons, say they're in for murder. It makes them seem badass, I guess. One guy told me he had come home to find his wife in bed with another man, so he killed them both. Only later did I find out that he raped an 8-year-old girl. Some of the nicest people you met in prison were sometimes the ones who had done the worst stuff. You just never knew who to believe. Some people told lies because they didn't want to accept what they had done. A couple of times I tried to tell people I didn't do it, but they usually just said,
You had to. If you didn't do it, you wouldn't be here.
Ricky had a bad habit of borrowing money from the loan sharks in prison, so he went in and out of protective custody. Somebody always seemed to be after him. One day I was out in the yard and spotted a wrench stuck between the fence, and I told Ricky about it later when I went to work.
You think you could get it to me?
Ricky asked.
They said if I didn't pay soon, I had two choices, blood on a shank or shit on a dick.
I knew Ricky was having a lot of trouble and ADSEG wasn't going to help him much. If you checked off, filling out a form requesting administrative segregation for yourself, word spread and they'd just come after you when you got out. Eventually, you had to pay in prison, one way or another.
Yeah, man, I can help you out, I said.
There was a boiler room near the area I had spotted the wrench, so I had him plan to meet me later in the yard so I could toss it over the fence to him just before I went inside. Later on, guards caught him with it and asked him where he got it from, and he sold me out. I did 6 days in the hole for that. It pissed me off, and Ricky thought I wanted to hurt him. He cowered when he saw me, but I told him he already had enough trouble to worry about. The hole was a 10-by-8-foot cell with a bunk, commode, and small sink. Some guys couldn't take being in there. They'd holler and scream, urinate, and defecate into cups to toss on the officers when they walked by. Others cut themselves. I tried to look at it as a room to go into to rest. It was a break from the population where I could catch up on correspondence without always having to look over my shoulder. To keep myself in shape, I filled trash bags with water and lifted them like the weights I used in the rec room and did sit-ups and push-ups. And I prayed. I prayed that seeing me again shook up Bobby Poole, that his conscience would gnaw at him, and that he'd eventually confess. Soon after I got out of lockup, Ricky transferred out to Odom Farm. The COs must have known enough about the contract on his head. A couple of months later, I spotted his cousin in the chow hall.
What's up? I nodded at him.
You hear about Ricky? He hung himself, stupid bastard, he said sadly.
It shocked me, knowing he went out like that after all the months we worked together packing cans. Here 1 minute, gone the next. It probably sounds crazy, but it made me feel like my problems weren't that big. Death or escape were not my only options. I still had a chance at an appeal, and I believed that the Lord had his reasons for me being in this situation. Sometimes all I had to cling to was the personal knowledge that I was innocent. And even if no one else knew that, God did. It made me feel more connected to him. My family tried to visit when they could, but it was harder for them to get down to Halifax. Still, they sent letters and money when they were able to. There were a few months where I didn't hear from Diane, and then I got a letter that explained why. She had been dating Tim, a guy she said looked and sounded just like Luther Vandross. But 4 months in, she found out Tim was a big liar. He was running coke and other drugs, and he was married. So one night they met at a motel, and Diane tried to end it. Tim wouldn't accept her answer. He took out his gun and told her he didn't want to live without her. Diane thought he was going to kill her, but instead he shot himself in the head. He just slumped over right on the bed, blood everywhere, and Diane ran out into the parking lot screaming her head off. The police tried to say Diane did it until they checked her hands for gunpowder and realized there was no way she could have been holding the gun. Someone told her, "You might as well leave town because they got it in for the Cottons." Once again, I could not be with my family when they needed me. I wanted to believe God had a plan, but I wondered if I would ever be anything other than a burden on my family. I prayed to God to give me the strength to endure, to keep me out of trouble with the other inmates. Much as I tried to keep to myself and release my tension on the punching bag, I didn't have control over what other inmates might do, especially the ones that were never going home. Put a man in a cage with beast and throw away the key, and it's usually not very long before the man is a beast himself. I knew my innocence would not matter if I gave in to the violence all around me. One morning I woke up and got my things from my locker and was getting ready to head out to the yard when Donnie appeared between the bunks, blocking my way. He looked completely crazy, like he just slithered out of some womb. Shirt off, hair slicked back, and all over his bare chest, arms, neck, and face he had smeared petroleum jelly. I'd have a hard time getting a grip on him, and it only took me a fraction of a second to spot the shoestring tied around his waist with a shank hanging from it.
"Red motherfucker," he spat.
I thought this really might be it. 5 years, 2 trials, and I would die there between the bunks, never able to clear my name. But maybe God was looking out for me, because another inmate sleeping nearby woke up and yelled, "Shut up!" And then some COs came in to see what all the commotion was. They hauled off Donnie to lockup. My days in medium custody out in the open dorm soon came to an end. I let a guy borrow my sneakers to play basketball. He put them back under my bunk when he was finished, and I forgot about it. But a few days later, while I was out in the yard, I got a call into the office.
"These your shoes?" they asked.
"Yeah." They pulled a homemade shank out of one of them.
"That's not mine," I said.
The officers didn't buy it, and I was busted back to close custody. In close custody, I had a lot less freedom to move around, and I got assigned field detail. Summer or winter, rain or shine, inmates were loaded up on the work bus and driven for 10 or 15 minutes to the farms, where they picked vegetables while armed guards on horseback kept an eye on them. In the end, staying in close custody, in a cell instead of exposed in the open dorms, probably kept me alive. After I was convicted for the second time, they appointed a guy from the appellate defender's office to handle my appeal to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. I didn't hear from him regularly, and I later learned that he had not raised the best argument available to me, that the judge had committed something called reversible error by keeping the pool evidence from the jury. I felt screwed. Of course, the North Carolina Court of Appeals upheld the conviction in August 1990. Later, a man named Malcolm Hunter, Jr. from the appellate defender's office delivered the news. Because of family reasons with the first guy, Mr. Hunter said he was taking over my case and that I still had another chance at the Supreme Court of North Carolina. It sank me fast. Much as I tried to prepare myself, I knew I was running out of options. August 8, 1990. "Dear Mr. Hunter, Jr., I received your sad mail today. It broke my heart to know that I was denied a new trial, knowing I'm an innocent man. I wish I was dead. I thought about doing something I know later down the road I would regret. I accept this losing battle, knowing I still have a chance in Supreme Court." 20 days later, I received his reply, in which he wrote, "Do not lose heart, Mr. Cotton. We have not finished your case by a long shot." In close custody, the single cells all faced the yard. Narrow windows gave us some natural light, but they were supposed to be sealed shut. A lot of us, though, figured out how to remove the ceiling in the frame so you could move the window up a little and get some fresh air. One day, when I was walking to the basketball court, a guy called to me from his window.
"Cotton, come here a minute. You want a cat?"
I stepped closer, and he passed me out a tiny calico kitten who had to be less than a month old. She had a tan spot between her eyes. I had a jacket on, so I put her down my sleeve, resting on my forearm. I took her back to my cell and put her on the floor. Then I went to the canteen and purchased milk and sardines. When I opened the tin, she squeaked a meow and buried her head in them. Then she lapped up the milk. After she got her fill, she hopped up on the bunk and crawled up on me, resting her head on my shoulder. I decided to call her Judy. When I'd get up in the morning, I had to make sure Judy was fed and put clean newspaper on the floor. After I showered in the evenings, she was usually there, waiting for me on my bunk. Although she liked her sardines and milk, Judy was still a little wild. She liked to come and go as she pleased, so I fixed my window to leave it up. I learned what she was trying to say. If her milk went bad, she'd hop up on the back of my commode and stare down at the water. And sometimes she'd come looking for me, running out in the yard through the population trying to spot my shoes. Judy got in a few scuffles with some of the other animals. Once she came back with a big scratch over her eye, and when she was about a year old, she had kittens herself. Someone told me they had spotted her on the work bus nursing about 4 kittens. Then she moved them to a trash can near the facility. I went out and retrieved them, carrying the babies, with their eyes still closed up, to my cell. That night, Judy came in and brought the kittens back outside, one by one, and placed them in a ditch near the work bus. For some reason, she just didn't want her babies inside. But there was a rainstorm, and the ditch flooded, drowning all the kittens. They moved me from a cell on the ground floor to the second floor, so I packed my belongings in a shopping bag and put her inside. "Stay down," I told her. But as I passed the guard station, she must have heard their voices and decided to investigate. Out popped her little head. "Cotton, you got to let that cat go," the CO said. So I took her out in the yard and put her down. I went up to my cell and looked out the window. Judy stood down in the yard meowing. I got to work, taking off the window seal and then shoved my blanket out through it. "Jump, Judy, jump," I called out. She hurled herself at it and dug in her claws so I could raise her up. And after that, when she wanted out, I'd put her on the blanket and lower her out until she could jump off. In 1991, the Supreme Court of North Carolina upheld my convictions. I read Mr. Hunter's letter and put it down on my chest. Judy hopped up, demanding I scratch her around the ears. "Looks like you're stuck with me," I told her. DOC officials informed me I was being shipped out again, this time to Southern Correctional Institution in Troy. A few weeks before the transfer, Judy disappeared. I had heard there were a couple of guys who were hurting the animals, slicing their tongues out, and I put the word out that if I found out someone did something to my cat, I'd kill him. But nothing ever came back to me, including Judy. I told myself Judy knew she didn't really belong here, and somehow wiggled out under one of the fences and maybe some young girl found her and took her in. That's how I pictured her, getting fat on some nice family's couch with nothing to worry about. Tootie and my father drove down to visit me once in Troy. They had gotten very lost, they said. Diane was supposed to come with them, but Tootie said her nerves were still shot. She had gone on disability after her boyfriend had committed suicide in front of her, and lived with my mother, taking care of her. We sat across from each other at a table, Troy being one of the prisons where you could have contact with your family, hug them, and take pictures. "Happy birthday, Ron," Tootie said. She had made me some cookies and gave me a card filled with money she had collected from the family. I had turned 30 a few months before. Looking at her and my father, I thought we all looked older. "How you holding up, son?" my father asked. He looked like an old man, his hand resting on top of a cane. Hell, 8 years had passed, and he was an old man. "The lawyer, Hunter, he says it's not over yet, but I don't know. I'm getting tired. Sometimes I think it would be easier to just let go and accept my situation." "We're still praying for you," Tootie said. "Somehow, some way, you're going to be free one day." "Toot, the Supreme Court denied the appeal."
"Who's got to confess one of these days? What man would want that mark on his soul?" my father said. I shrugged. He didn't seem to mind lying in court. "Look, son, my health's not good. There's going to come a time where I can't travel the distance to visit you anymore. I'll still write you and send you what I can. Justice will prevail.
I know in my heart that God will see to it that justice is done, my father said. But there's nothing left after the Supreme Court. The lawyer said there wasn't anything to take it up to the federal court. That door is closed. Then you're going to have to wait for one to open, he said. Or find the window, Tootie said, laughing. It lifted my heart up to hear her laugh. When you moved between units in prison or went from the visiting area to the dorms, you'd go through sally ports. You'd walk through a door into a sealed kind of hallway, and the door would close behind you and lock. Someone would be watching on a camera or from a booth nearby, and you had to wait before they opened the next door in front of you. This was how they controlled the population flow in case of a riot. It was also how they'd seal the doors off. Outside the visitation area, I stepped into the sally port, hearing the buzz that signaled the door behind me had closed. I waited, just like my father said, for another door to open. Chapter 10. Early in September 1992, Mr. Hunter wrote me to say that an attorney and law professor named Richard Rosen had agreed to look into my case to see if anything could be done to help me. Mr. Hunter wanted to know if I was interested in his help. After so many doors had been slammed shut, I jumped at the chance for someone to find a way to crack open one of them and shine light on the truth. I wrote him back immediately. September 9th, 1992. Mr. Hunter, Jr. Sir, yes, I'd really appreciate the assistance of Mr. Rosen, and I want to thank you for doing what you could to help me. I really do. I feel if I don't get any help from the court system, I might as well call this place home. I have been incarcerated 8 years now for crimes I know I never committed, and God is my witness. I hurt daily and find it difficult to accept what I'm now having to go through. No one understands, and it seems no one cares. I've been fighting this battle a very long time, and my mind and heart have been left with a trademark that I'll never be able to overcome. There have been times that I wish I was never born, because the life in which I now live is nothing but pure hurt. I'd rather be dead and in hell than to have to spend the rest of my entire life wasting away here. I've done things that I'm not too proud of myself, but I don't deserve this, sir. Sincerely, Ronald Cotton. Richard Rosen was a full-time professor at UNC Chapel Hill, home of my favorite basketball team, the Tar Heels. He was a very busy man, but he wrote me right away, and soon after sent a student down to interview me. They said they were going through all the transcripts from the trials. October 4th, 1992. Dear Mr. Rosen, I received your letter and was pleased to learn that you are willing to assist me in my tragic situation. By all means, God bless you, and I wish you the very best of luck. I'm hoping and praying that you're able to open some doors in this matter. Mr. Rosen, allow me to say I'm an innocent man, and there is no doubt I was indeed framed basically from my past record and my interracial relationship that I was involved in at the time of the crimes I was accused and convicted of. God is my witness. Sir, I honestly feel without a doubt that the people involved that caused me to get falsely convicted know that I'm innocent, but just wanted me off the streets, and they've done a pretty good job of it, wouldn't you say? I've been incarcerated since August 1st, 1984, and living my life in the system has been extremely difficult knowing I'm innocent. Waking up every day as I do these last 8 years, knowing I'm serving time for another man's crime. It's not easy, and it's been rough on my family as well, especially my poor mother and father. My father lives in Orange County, and if you need to get in touch with him, you may at this address in Hillsborough, North Carolina. Phone 919. I've just forgotten my own father's phone number. This place really has me mixed up, but I'm going to make it one way or the other. I haven't heard anything concerning Bobby Leon Poole because he's at Caledonia Odom Complex, located in Halifax County. I did learn he was telling people he was in for armed robbery, and how he once stalked women out late at night and raped them. That man, Poole, I feel without a doubt has me doing his time, and I'm willing to submit to any test that's available to prove to the courts I'm not guilty. Sincerely, Ronald Cotton. That fall, I met Mr. Rosen in person. Immediately, he told me to call him Rich. Even though he wasn't as formal as Phil, he didn't wear suits much and his shirt was never tucked in, he looked very much in control. He was a slim, trim guy with a bad back, and his hair was going gray, it seemed to me, from wisdom of being in the law for so long. He told me he was going to ask a Burlington attorney, a former student of his named Tom Lambeth, to help out with the case. Tom was local, Rich explained. He had grown up in Burlington, so he knew all the players in the community. I thought bringing in Tom sounded like a good idea. Before he left, Rich said, "I can't promise you anything, but we'll do our best." Their plan was to reinvestigate the case from the beginning. I really felt that they were going to do everything they could to achieve true justice, not because they were getting paid either. I was considered indigent. My family didn't have the money to pay for a private attorney, so Rich stood to gain nothing from all the work he was doing. No one forced him to take this on. Rich said he and Tom had met with Phil and Dan, who turned over all the files from my case. Rich kept me very well informed of what was going on throughout the rest of the year. It was more contact than I ever had with any lawyer since I had been incarcerated, and it really helped me feel that things were moving in my case, that it wasn't just sitting like still water. In early November, I spoke with my father by phone. He told me he'd be willing to do what the good Lord allowed him to do money-wise, to help out the lawyers with their investigation. I knew sometimes the state had the money to hire private investigators, but if you were like me, from a poor family, you were stuck with the lawyer the court assigned to you. More often than not, the court-appointed attorneys didn't care a bit about you. They weren't getting their regular rate, and they didn't have the budget to do a lot of investigating. If you want to call anything about my situation lucky, though, at least I had Phil Mosley. I had to give Phil credit for still caring after we lost the second trial, when he didn't owe me anything. But I guess the blood evidence really shook him. Later, he told me it was a 1 o'clock in the morning revelation. Finding that the spot of blood on Mrs. Reynolds's door frame matched Poole's blood type, not mine. Stuff the jury and the appeals court wouldn't know. My letters could have just gone into his heartbreak pile. But Rich told me Phil wrote the appellate defender's office when he found out they had not raised important issues on the appeal. I guess that first guy had just done a rush job, and Mr. Hunter felt bad about it. Without that, I don't know if Mr. Hunter would have gotten me to Rich. December rolled around pretty quickly that fall. Decembers could be hard for me, harder than the other months because of my birthday and Christmas. On the outside, days like that mattered. But in here, you wanted to do your best to forget them, make days like those just like any other kind of day. In an effort to cheer up the place, the J.C. Club would paint backgrounds, though, and put them up in the visitation room and a couple of other areas around the prison. They went by the season, so around Christmas time they'd hang a big sheet of paper with a fireplace drawn on it. If you wanted, you could take a Polaroid picture in front of it for a couple of bucks to send to your family. Sitting in front of those painted fireplaces, though, only reminded me how far I was from home. I missed it every day. That Christmas, my mom and my sisters, Tootie, Sheila, and Diane, said they were coming to see me. They made a huge home-cooked meal of potato salad, collard greens, smoked chicken, turkey dressing, green beans, and sweet potato pie. I was very excited about their visit. But Christmas Day came and went, and I waited for the COs to call me out. But no call ever came. Later on, I learned that my family had been 10 minutes late. And since they were not there on time, they had been turned back, dishes of food and all. Sheila told me later that my mother was so upset she couldn't eat a bite of it when they got back. Rich had sent me an update about a week before Christmas. He wrote, "Right now I feel pulled in two different directions. On one hand, I'd like to move pretty fast. I think that the judge who was going to be in Alamance County for the next 6 months would be a good judge to hear your case. I also feel we have a good claim that your appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to raise a claim about the judge keeping the pool evidence out. Both of these things make me want to file a motion for appropriate relief no later than the middle of February. On the other hand, my experiences have convinced me that this is probably the only chance we will ever have to put up evidence in your case. In other words, even if we lose and appeal your case for the next 10 years, we might never be able to present anything we overlook now. So we need to make sure that we take a very hard look at the entire case to see if there's more investigation we can do. As far as I was concerned, time was the only thing I had plenty of. If what Rich said was true, then this was probably the last chance for the truth to come out. He had explained that the motion for appropriate relief was something the lawyers did when all the direct state court appeals were exhausted, something like a Hail Mary play. It was the only way to get into court and have a judge consider certain mistakes that had been made throughout my case. I didn't care how long it took. I wrote Rich back to tell him I put my trust in him and Tom and God. I also told him I didn't feel the first appellate defender had represented my case to the fullest, because he hadn't raised any issue about the all-white jury. I wanted to know what Rich thought of that, but in the end, I trusted they would make the right decisions about when to act in my case. Hell, I wasn't going anywhere. February came and went, and they didn't file the motion. Rich explained that they were being very careful with the timing of everything. In the meantime, the Department of Corrections moved me again in 1993, this time to Harnett, a small penitentiary in Lillington, North Carolina. Every time they moved me, I worried about the trouble that was going to find me. Would I die trying to defend myself? Would I kill someone in self-defense? The pointless violence of the hopeless and those whose minds were not right was always around me. I tried so hard to keep my nose clean so nothing would interfere with my case. Should God give me the chance to go before a court of law again? Rich and Tom sent me many letters about how the investigation was progressing. As far as my evidence went, they explained that legally it might be nothing more than ashes at this point. Since I had gotten convicted and lost my two appeals, the law said everything could go to the incinerator. They were eager to file a motion to preserve evidence, so that if anything was left, no one could suggest that it be destroyed. Toward the end of 1993, Rich told me the motion to preserve evidence had been granted, and that they had affidavits from the waitresses at Summer Seafood who worked with me, who said I never harassed or touched them while I was there. He also wrote, "I'm not sure that there is anything we can do with the all-white jury suggestion. You and I both know that having an all-white jury can be incredibly prejudicial, especially in a case involving a black defendant and white victims. I just don't see a legal claim based on that here." Before I knew it, 1993 became 1994, and as much as I tried not to pay attention to the time, there was no getting around the fact that a decade had passed. My brother wrote to tell me our father had had a stroke and was now in a rest home. Life went on. Guilty or innocent, crazy or sane, healthy or sick, it just went on. The anger and shock I felt at the beginning left me long ago. I don't want to say I accepted my fate because it sounds like I gave up. I still prayed to God that I would be free again. But the more I thought about it, the more Diane was right. You had to be free in your heart. Guilt, fear, anger, they were all their own kinds of prison. You could be out in the world and still be doing time. Part of my finding that peace within myself was learning that I was strong enough to carry the load the Lord had asked me to. I knew I would not crack, even if I spent the rest of my life here. The other part was thinking about the women who said I had attacked them. At one point early on, I had a lot of anger toward them. But in time, I realized they had been through something and made a mistake. They weren't saying I did it because they wanted to hurt me. Then, in 1994, came the news of O.J. Simpson and the murders of his ex-wife and her boyfriend. At Lillington, I took to standing out in the yard, watching the other inmates, with my back against the wall and my headphones plugged into my radio. Like almost everyone else in prison, I was hooked on news about O.J. Simpson. In the chow halls, out in the yard, it was all anyone talked about. It looked like they were really going to bury the Jews. On the radio, the news talked a lot about the blood that had been found and some kind of scientific test that was more accurate than anything else. 99% accurate. It was a test called DNA. I tried to learn everything I could about it before I brought it up with Rich. Rich and Tom came to visit me at Harnett and Lillington. It was the first time I met Tom Lambeth in person. He was younger than Rich, also on the short side, but a bit more round. He had large glasses and curly brown hair, and he smiled a lot for a lawyer. Ron, the purpose of us meeting today is to discuss the motion for DNA testing. As you know, we reinvestigated the case from the beginning, and you saw the motion. We think we've got some good legal claims here where we might win the motion and get you a new trial. But if we ask for DNA, well, it's kind of like, be careful what you ask for. Tom picked it up from there. Ron, if that DNA testing puts you there, there's not a judge in the world that's going to grant our motion. It's over. You're going to stay here. You told us you were innocent, and we believe you. But you can never really know as a lawyer. Only you know. We're just here to see what issues we can raise for you. It's fish or cut bait time. Do you really want us to pursue DNA testing? Without wavering for a second, I looked them back straight in the eye. I promise you I didn't do it. My DNA is not going to be in there. I thought of the hairs they plucked from my head and my pubic area, the blood and the saliva from all those years ago. Would it really be those little things that made all the difference? After they left, I took my portable radio and my headphones and headed out to the track in the yard. I don't know how many times I walked around and around, looking back in my mind on everything that had happened in the last 10 years. The trials, the appeals, the way pool would pop up somewhere like a weed I couldn't get rid of. All of the legal proceedings felt like spinning circles, too. I went so far only to wind up in the same place I had started. If DNA was as good as they said, it was my last hope of getting out of the ring. When the sun started to go down behind the buildings, a vibe came over me that I was going to leave this place very soon. I headed inside. Mr. Cotton, the classification committee is recommending you for transfer to Tennessee. We've got some papers for you to fill out, said one of the prison officials sitting at the table in front of me. It was the end of 1994, and I had been called into an office for a meeting. I had read in the News Observer that the governor of North Carolina had met with officials from several states, including Rhode Island and Tennessee, to see what could be done about prison overcrowding. But it never occurred to me that I might be one of the inmates moved. My mother and father, getting on in the years as they were and in failing health, would not be able to make the 11-hour drive to Tennessee very easily for a 2-hour visit. And even if their health were better, it took money to travel that far. Money that my family didn't have. I don't want to go, sir, I said. The decision of the Raleigh Committee is not negotiable. What if I refuse this? Mr. Cotton, whether or not you sign these papers, you will be handcuffed, shackled, and if need be, lifted up and placed on that plane to Tennessee. The Department of Corrections didn't care that a move out of state would make it impossible for my family to visit, and that those visits helped me survive.
Like a pinball, I'd already been shot back and forth and up and down the state to 4 different prisons. And now that I finally had some new attorneys making some progress on my case, they were shipping me out so I couldn't receive visits from them either. As a consolation, they promised we'd have daily phone privileges in Tennessee. So within a few months, they shackled me, handcuffed me, and put a chain through my belt loop so that my handcuffs were connected to my leg shackles. I shuffled out to a big old Grey Goose bus, and we drove out to Raleigh-Durham Airport. Out on the tarmac, a plane waited for us. As I got off the bus, I noticed on the side of the plane it said, Express 1. I turned to the guy behind me and nodded at it. I guess that's because it's only one way, huh? Maybe God had a strange sense of humor. This wasn't quite what I had in mind when I got the feeling that I would be leaving Harnett. It was only my second time on a plane. When I had been very young, I'd ridden on one. The roar of the engines and the feeling that nothing held us to the earth anymore had scared me so much I urinated on myself. I decided that this was probably not a good story to tell the guy I sat next to. There were 3 rows of 3, filled with male and female inmates. I had a window seat. We lifted up, and I watched Raleigh and the rest of North Carolina grow small below us. The fields and ponds I'd played in, the woods I'd chased my brothers and sisters through, the dirt roads we had flown down in my father's car, waiting for the bumps that would send us shooting off the seat, all of it faded below the clouds until I couldn't see anything. 11 years and 700 miles from home, I wondered if the next time I touched North Carolina soil, my body would be in a box. We landed on the Tennessee Air Force Base about an hour or so later. They loaded up all the men on a couple of buses, making us get on starting from the back to the front, filling the seats. After we filed on, a bald-headed guy with a big old Buddha belly stepped on. He stood up front and stared at us. I could read the letters WTDC on his shirt. Y'all from North Carolina. Y'all think you're bad. That's because you ain't been to Tennessee yet. When we pulled in to West Tennessee Detention Center, Buddha Belly stood up again. Welcome to your new home, ladies. There's some COs that can't wait to get to know you. We're going to get real cozy real fast. They strip-searched us and then sent us off to our assigned bunks. There were about 80 people to a dorm, 2 bunks high. I didn't even bother to fill out a visitation list because I knew I would not have any visitors. I took a job in the prison laundry and did everything I could to stay under the radar and focus on what Rich and Tom were trying to do in my case. Rich sent me a copy of the motion for appropriate relief they had mailed to the clerk in Alamance County. Rich explained it was the state of North Carolina's way of giving me one more shot at a trial, because enough evidence had come up post-conviction that made it seem as if I didn't have a fair trial. It was a huge document, with affidavits signed by Phil and Dan and the waitresses I had worked with at Summer's Seafood, who said I never did anything improper, and a whole chart studying the patterns in Bobby Poole's crimes and how they were similar to the rapes of the 2 women I had been convicted for. Now, I wasn't a lawyer or a judge, but I was mighty impressed. In August, Rich informed me that he and Tom had gone down to the Burlington Police Department to see what evidence was still there. They met with one of the detectives who had interrogated me, Mike Galden, and the evidence custodian. Detective Galden had turned over the box of evidence and said, "You know, it's just going to prove what we already know. Cotton did it." Tom said he'd just smiled politely and replied, "We'll see about that." A few months later, Rich wrote to tell me that the order for DNA testing was approved. They had gone with the ADA into the judge's chambers and said they weren't trying to pull any tricks. They just wanted to know the truth once and for all. Rich told me the assistant DA, Rob Johnson, seemed like a good guy, but he told him if the DNA test came back and put me at the crime scenes, he expected the motion to go away. It was just past Christmas, and his letter was a gift that lifted my spirits.
There was a new year just around the corner. I went back to the waiting game. Waiting for news, thinking about what might or might not be, I started having nightmares. I had the same one over and over. I was in the swimming hole in Glen Raven. Out in the water, I felt myself getting sucked down again. There were people standing on the bank, and I called out for them to help me, but I had no voice. Nothing came out. I was getting so tired trying to swim out of the hole. Then I noticed the water felt sticky, and all of a sudden I realized it was blood. I'd wake up with my heart pounding like rain on a tin roof. I don't know what I was more afraid of, the fact that this was my last shot at freedom and it could all backfire like it had before, or that it might work, and I would finally walk out into the world again. The struggle for justice all these years had made me grow up and take responsibility for myself. It had given my life a focus. Whichever way the decision went, when the battle was done, I wasn't sure what I'd do with myself. Flipping to the dog-eared pages of my Bible, I read from the Book of Psalms to ease my mind. In thee, O Lord, do I put my trust. Let me never be put to confusion. Deliver me in thy righteousness, and cause me to escape. Incline thine ear unto me, and save me. Deliver me, O my God, out of the hand of the wicked, out of the hand of the unrighteous and cruel man. Early in 1995, Rich wrote to let me know that the State Bureau of Investigation's lab did not have the ability to perform the DNA test, but that there was a private lab that could do it, and the evidence was already in their hands. My father, being in the nursing home, couldn't help out financially, but somehow the test was going to get done anyway. Then, a few months later, Rich and I got to talk on the phone. He told me that he and Tom had been to a meeting at the lab in Raleigh to view the results of the DNA test on the Reynolds case.
"It's not a match, Ron. Your markers weren't in there."
I thought this was good news, but something in his voice told me it wasn't all good, so I waited for him to go on. "Unfortunately, the lab folks haven't been able to identify any DNA at all from the Thompson case samples, aside from hers and her boyfriend's."
"Mr. Rosen, what does that mean?"
"Well, Ron, it doesn't clear you. They didn't find DNA that was yours, but they also didn't find any mystery DNA. There's just no evidence either way, so we're still left with litigating that case. The lab will file a report, and hopefully we'll get a date set for the hearing. We're going to ask the court to consider the DNA evidence from the Reynolds case hearing as newly discovered evidence in the Thompson case. Basically, as the Supreme Court held in your first appeal, it is extremely likely that the same person committed both crimes, so evidence that proves you didn't commit the Reynolds attack is powerful new evidence that you did not commit the Thompson attack." I thought of the two trials and Jennifer Thompson telling the jury she was sure it was me. I worried that her words were stronger than any kind of scientific test. "It's frustrating, I know, but we'll see what we can do. You take care of yourself, Ron. I'll be in touch as things develop." I didn't know how much more my nerves could take. I resolved to put the case out of my mind. There was nothing more I could do now. May 16th, 1995. "Dear Mr. Rosen, sir, we know that this matter at hand is very serious, and it's been a long time since this case has been worked on. I really appreciate the effort you have put into this case, not to mention Tom, etc. I'm glad things are still looking good, and hopefully all goes well and this case will be before some judge. Mr. Rosen, I have made up in my mind not to worry about anything that's taking place in this case right now. I will soon be incarcerated 11 years come in August, and if I should be released today from prison, I'd be one lost young man."
Part 3. Jennifer and Ronald. Chapter 11. Jennifer. March 1995. The spring day the phone rang. I had already cleaned most of the house, inasmuch as you can keep a house clean when you have 3 almost 5-year-olds who mark their paths by shedding toys from room to room. I was down in the playroom, surrounded by Playmobil toys and matchbox cars, when the trill of the phone shot through from the guest bedroom. I stepped into the room. My husband and I referred to it as the costume department because I had filled the closet in there with outfits from thrift stores that the kids could dress up in, create plays around. The Cruella de Vil dress, the G.I. Joe shirt, the Russian Tsar coat. Hello? Jennifer? It's Mike Golden. Mike, how are you? How's Karen? I said. It had probably been at least a year since we had spoken, but I would have recognized his voice instantly, even if he hadn't told me who was calling. Good, good. We're good. How about you? Vinny's busy finishing up his master's degree. The kids are getting ready to graduate, and I'm probably washing my 100th pound of laundry this week. Graduate? From preschool. They start kindergarten in the fall, I explained. Kindergarten? Where does the time go? He laughed and paused a minute. Jennifer, I've got something to talk to you about. I'd like to come by. Well, sure, you know I'd love to see you. How's tomorrow, then? Were it not for the fact that I was talking to Mike, whose very voice calmed me, and the 3 small children I had in the next room, I might have completely panicked. Tomorrow? Something was up. Mike was now captain at the Burlington Police Department, and he certainly wasn't coming to see how the kids were doing. Wow. Okay. Is everything all right? Everything's fine. We just need to talk in person. I'm bringing the assistant district attorney with me. How's 11? 11 is fine. See you then. I hung up the phone and stared at it sitting dumbly in its cradle. I looked out the window into the backyard of the house I shared in Winston-Salem with my husband Vinny, our triplets, and our dog Bingo. My son Blake's protesting voice drifted in from the playroom, followed by peals of his sister's laughter. Poor Blake never had a choice. He had to do what Brittany and Morgan wanted to do, or else they excluded him. My stomach cramped. Had Ronald Cotton escaped? Was he coming up for parole? Were we all in danger? When the first trial ended in 1985 and they took Ronald Cotton away for life, everyone expected me to move on. Instead, I fell apart. Paul and I had been fighting constantly, and we both knew we were not going to make it. It would have been in extremely poor taste for him, being such a small town and all, to not be there with me through the trial. But just a month later, we mutually agreed to end things. Paul had been so afraid to look at me a certain way, or touch me a certain way, or say something a certain way, and I guess in the end I felt like he couldn't get over it. He wanted to graduate from business school, return to Burlington, and be looked up to in the community I loathed. And I'm sure he probably thought, but would never admit, what kind of wife and mother would I, the traumatized rape victim, be? I tried to focus on finishing my final semester of school so I could get the heck out of Burlington as soon as